This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, and thank you for joining me this Friday afternoon, the end of the week. But I actually don't think I should really say that. It doesn't really apply in the agricultural world, especially at this time of the year. There's no real end of the week. But anyway, happy Friday. I am Kate Forrester with you from now up until 1 o'clock. And a little later on in the program, I'm going to check in on the wool market with Justin Haydock and how it's been tracking this week. I actually caught up with Justin in person this morning to go through everything that has been going on the past 7 days, and also just to get a little bit more of a bigger picture of where demand is coming from globally for our wool. And also, while we're on the topic of wool, we are going to head all the way back to the 1970s. Well, in your case, it might not be all the way back. It may have been just yesterday, but back to the 1970s to reminisce about the much debated wool floor price. So all of that coming up after the news headlines at 12:30, and also checking in with the Bureau of Meteorology and the rainfall, of course, with Richard Hudson. It is 12:06 on the Country Hour right across Western Australia, whether you're listening on your radio or the ABC Listen app. Thank you for joining me. Well, Australia's new environment legislation became law this morning after the Greens' support allowed the bill to sail through the Senate yesterday. And I am keen to hear from you, the Savo. Are you worried what impact these new laws might have on farmers wanting to clear land? The text number today is 0448 922 604. And yesterday, the National Farmers Federation's Warwick Ragg said he was disappointed. He was also unclear on what the new legislation will mean for agriculture.
So what we've seen today is an announcement by the Prime Minister that they're going to put closer controls on high-risk land clearing. That terminology, high-risk land clearing, is a new term. We're trying to understand what that means. And we understand, though we've not seen this in writing yet, that that effectively means there's a limit on regrowth age of 15 years. So if your regrowth is older than 15 years, it probably means that you're not going to be able to touch it. Now, having said that, land clearing is a province of the states. And we don't know how this is going to interact with various state legislations, and we're not sure which parts of the EPBC Act are going to be required to be aligned to whatever state regimes are in place. During next year, we will see a need to develop matters of national environmental significant standards, which will have bilaterals following, and those things will be critical to understand how this is going to impact. So whatever law they pass today will have to come with some subsequent explanation about how it's going to work, how we're going to operate, how we're going to undertake standardised agricultural practice.
Warwick Ragg is the NFF's Head of Natural Resource Management. And this morning, Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt added that clarification on what the new laws will mean for farmers.
You know, the changes that we've introduced regarding agricultural land clearing in these reforms, they will help to bring down our emissions as well. But we know there's more to be done, but there's no one more committed to the task than Chris Bowen and the Albanese government.
The National Farmers Federation says it's very concerned by the announcement of closer controls on high-risk land clearing, saying that the specifics are unclear. Can you provide any clarity to the farmers?
Yeah, sure. This didn't get a huge amount of media coverage yesterday, Sally, so it is worth me just quickly stepping us through it. The issue that we've dealt with here is that under the current EPBC Act, agricultural land clearing in most situations is exempt from the EPBC Act. So farmers are currently able to clear agricultural land, even if it has a significant impact on threatened species or other protected matters, without needing any assessment or approval under the EPBC Act. Now, that's different to every other industry. If mining companies, if renewable companies, if housing developers want to clear land in a way that's going to have a significant impact on the environment, they need to get an EPBC assessment and approval. And what we've done is remove the current exemption for that agricultural land clearing to bring it in line with other industries if we're talking about land clearing of regrowth, so land that's previously been cleared and has grown back, regrowth that's been there for 15 years or more. And equally, we're also lifting the exemption for land clearing that is within 50 metres of rivers or creeks in the Great Barrier Reef catchment. And the reason for the second one, to do with the reef, is that we know that one of the major impacts on the Great Barrier Reef is sediment runoff that occurs when trees are cleared very close to rivers and creeks in the catchment. So this will assist to reduce that sediment runoff. And what it really comes down to, and it's very similar for the changes that we've made to forestry as well, is that those two industries have not had to follow the same rules as every other industry, and now they will, which I think is only fair.
All right. Well, that was Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt speaking to Sally Sara on RN Breakfast this morning. And as you heard him, he has said that the biggest change is going to be that streamlining of the developmental process for so many projects. So in a way, he's saying it's going to get rid of duplication and it's going to be a quicker process when it comes to environmental projects. 10 past 12 on the Country Hour. Please let me know your thoughts on what Murray Watt just had to say. And also if you have anything to share on what Warwick Ragg, the head of the Natural Resource Management at NFF, also shared. Text number today is 0448 922 604. Are you worried what impact this might have on whether you can now clear land on your farm or not? Let me know. Well, much like the NFF, the WA Forest Industry Federation is still seeking clarity on the details of the newly passed legislation. Adele Farina is the WA Forest Industries Federation Chief Executive. Adele, now that these laws have officially passed, what's your reaction?
Look, industry is understandably very concerned about the turn of events which happened overnight. We, however, still need more details. The regulations are yet to be drafted. Bilaterals are yet to be negotiated. While consultation is progressing with two of the national environmental standards, these have not yet been finalised. And there are more standards yet to be drafted. So the next 12 to 18 months, finalising these processes will be critical.
Could you just run me through what are your concerns when it comes to these laws?
Look, our fundamental concerns are the impact of the laws with respect to ecological thinning in native forestry. While I would be shocked that it would impact that, until we get clarification, that remains a concern. A concern with respect to plantation establishment and management. Currently through the RFAs, we only are required to go through state environmental approvals. If that changes and is not incorporated into the bilaterals, that could be a concern. The impact of any of the national environmental standards with regard to these processes. The other likely impact will be with respect to private native forestry. While there's very little in WA, if it impacts the sustainable management of private native forests, that will have an impact for industry as well. The other aspect is we need greater clarity on the regional planning focus that has been mentioned by Murray Watson is in the legislation. We need to understand exactly what's proposed by that. My current understanding is that it will identify go and no-go zones.
And where do you look to for that information? Who do you think will be able to provide you with that clarification?
Well, we're hoping that clarification will filter through over coming weeks and months as the Commonwealth Government turns its mind to all of these matters. We've also requested a meeting with our State Forestry Minister, the Honourable Jackie Jarvis, to discuss our concerns and to have a discussion with respect to the state's discussions with the Commonwealth with respect to bilaterals.
You've just come out of a briefing this morning with the Australian Products Forestry Association. What was that about?
Look, fundamentally, just giving us an oversight of where they understood things to be at. Clearly, more questions than answers at this point in time. And really was just an opportunity to brief members on where things are at. As I indicated, there's a lot of work yet to be done to fully understand the implications of this deal with the Greens for forestry.
Well, you just heard from Murray Watt, who was speaking to Sally Sara this morning on radio. What did you make of what he had to say?
Look, I take some comfort in the fact that he focused and said that the focus of the new laws are to remove duplications, and that is requiring approvals at two levels of government. And so we are keen to understand how discussions with respect to the bilaterals with the states will progress, because obviously we're keen to ensure that that focus by Murray Watt is carried through in those bilaterals for forestry.
Adele, if we look at this from a WA perspective, how significant do you believe the impact will be on the southwest native forestry sector?
Look, we don't have commercial scale native forestry in Western Australia anymore. That was ended back in 2023. The only operations that are occurring in native forests currently is ecological thinning, and that ecological thinning is for forest health. So I would be stunned if it were the case that they were impacted in any adverse way. After all, the whole purpose of undertaking that activity is for forest health. It could well be that the impacts will be minimal. It could be that they are significant.
It's just a wait and see at this point in time.
Look, yes, there's a process that we need to go through, and there's lots to be discussed yet.
Well, within these new laws, the Prime Minister also announced Labor would establish a $300 million forestry growth fund, which he has said is going to back forestry and timber workers. Would that $300 million forest growth fund mean anything to us here in the West?
Certainly, it's open to everyone right across the country. We are still waiting on more detail on that $300 million fund. Industry welcomes it. This announcement has largely come out of the National Fibre Strategy that was agreed with the national government and was published a few months ago. This is the first stage of implementation of that strategy, and that was negotiated with industry. So we very much welcome the commitment by the Commonwealth Government. You know, we remain hopeful that it will actually target those areas that need to be targeted and to provide industry with the support that it needs. It's open to everyone. It'll be up to businesses in Western Australia to determine whether they fit the criteria to be able to apply for those funds. And as yet, that criteria is unknown.
Well, I will definitely keep an eye on proceedings. I'm sure you will be too, Adele, very closely. Thank you for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thank you very much.
Adele Farina is the WA Forest Industries Federation Chief Executive. 17 past 12. And on the text line, a couple of you want to have your say about these new laws that have passed through overnight. Mary from Esperance says, these new laws just show how hypocritical Labor and the Greens are. They will destroy our farming land to put their turbines up. Can you please get an expert to answer the question? Why are our grain prices so low if climate change's greatest threat to humans is food security? Please make it make more sense. Mary from Esperance, thank you for sharing your thoughts. And Dee has texted in to say, Murray Watt, the minister against agriculture. What a sick joke. Thank you for texting in 0448 922 604 if you want to have your say. Well, one person with a passion for trees and forestry is David Humphreys, who has a property in the Ferguson Valley near Bunbury. He runs beef cattle, but over the years has realised how bees and trees fit beautifully into their farming system.
My first exposure to agroforestry was probably through my parents, who planted pine on the family's beef cattle farm back in the mid-70s. So my two older brothers and I grew up spending the weekends and school holidays pruning trees and playing in the shade and so forth. So that's probably where the passion for growing trees came from.
Just with that, obviously, from your parents' experience, is that something you saw them succeed in and going forth into your own farming, you decided to take it on?
Probably a number of learnings from that. You know, the initial plantings were in a sort of agroforestry wide-spaced planting configuration, which required a lot more management than if they're planted in more of a intensive block or, you know, sort of more of a plantation type grouping of trees in the landscape.
looking back to when you did start, what has been the biggest surprise, good or bad, about managing trees alongside your other enterprises on the farm?
Well, it's a challenge to select just the one surprise, but if I had to, it'd probably be the quiet thrill of admiring trees that you've been responsible for establishing and knowing that these can be either retained for any number of environmental or aesthetic benefits or producing a source of income. And if I can add maybe one extra surprise, is how much more attention you'd pay to trees and notice when they're flowering once you have the bees. So many trees only have very small flowers. And before we had bees, it would only be of a passing interest if the flowers were even noticed. But once you're operating an apiary or even a few beehives, you pay a lot more attention to what bees are foraging on when they're flowering. So the flowering habitat of trees is often very much linked to weather and rainfall events and provides some valuable insights into understanding what's happening on the farm and in the landscape.
And you mentioned before about the income streams. Timber and carbon credits are often talked about as income streams from integrated trees. How have you tapped into those markets and how realistic is it for other farmers to get involved?
Yeah, so growing trees for timber production is very realistic. I'm not as confident about carbon credits, but this might just be more my perception and lack of understanding versus reality. Trees are really no different to any other sort of cropping or livestock management. You know, they require careful selection of the right tree species for the soil types, rainfalls, their intended purpose and market demand. We've successfully grown trees and achieved a meaningful return from a range of timber products, you know, whether it's pine for dimensional lumber, blue gum for wood chip for paper production, yellow stringy bark for firewoods, or specialty timbers for furniture. You know, with respect to carbon credits, you know, there's been a fair degree of swirl and moving of the goalposts by policymakers and bureaucrats over the years. And that's created, you know, a complexity and uncertainty around carbon credits, at least in my mind.
Some farmers in the industry might worry that these trees or integrated trees might compete with pasture or take land away from their livestock. How have you managed that balance and have you seen any real trade-offs?
Yeah, so like any farming operation, you know, there's always a need for balance and trade-offs in decision-making. You know, whether you're cropping or running livestock, growing and integrating trees as part of that farming operation is no different. So like any careful decision-making on a farm, you know, there's a whole range of variables that, you know, need to be considered. So in our situation, for instance, we wouldn't grow trees that drop limbs alongside our hay paddocks. And while trees, you know, will create some shading effect on nearby pastures, the overall benefit of having trees help reduce wind and weather impacts on pasture and livestock is outweighs that impact on the shading effect.
And just for farmers out there that might be thinking about planting their own trees, one of the toughest lessons you've learnt and maybe the biggest opportunity they might be missing out on?
There's probably two lessons that come to mind. Firstly, ensure you complete site preparation to a high standard and do it early. And by this I mean, you know, complete your ripping and or mounding where that's necessary and weed control well in advance so the seedlings can be planted at their optimal time. And secondly, trees take time to grow. You know, we have a farm where we had 40 hectares of 38-year-old pines harvested a few years ago that we've been meaning to replant, but we've got a new farm that's taking up a fair bit of time and effort. And as a result, we've lost probably 3 years now of growth if it moved on that and got it re-established. So we've also got the added expense and effort of having to remove the pine wildlings. So while trees do require ongoing management, the bulk of the effort is growing trees in their initial establishment. After that, they can be left to do their thing, which is grow. Parting comment would be any farmers that are thinking about planting trees in the landscape is, you know, do your research, get good advice, use things such as decision tree and the various expertise that are out there, or do your own homework before selecting trees and where to plant them and how best to get the most out of the effort. You know, they're not without a lot of effort and time, and it's a long-term investment, but it pays dividends in the end.
David Humphreys runs a beef, bees and trees operation in the Ferguson Valley in the southwest, and he was speaking to Rachel Boothman.
The WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
24 past 12. Now, you may have heard the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority has changed the regulations covering the use of the chemical dimethylate on berries. because it's worried about the health impact its use might have, especially on children. Farmers will now have to wait at least 14 days after applying the chemical before harvesting berries to allow for more time for the chemical to break down. David Claughton has been looking at how the authority reached its decision.
Dimethylwhite is an insecticide used to protect blueberries, raspberries and blackberries from fruit fly. And growers have been able to use it right up until 24 hours before picking. But the consumption of berries has grown exponentially in recent years. And the APVMA is concerned that may be affecting children's health. Here's the chief executive, Scott Hansen, explaining the change.
Our decision to suspend the 11 products, dimethylwhite products that are used on berries, means that it's illegal to use those products in accordance with what's on their labels at the moment. What's on the labels at the moment says there's a one-day withholding period between when the product is applied to the blueberries to the time in which the blueberries are harvested. And what we have done is issued a permit that allows for those suspended products to still be able to be used, but with a withholding period or a period between when it's treated and when it can be harvested of now 14 days, because the science and the data shows us that at the 14-day mark post-treatment, we have that lower level of remaining residues. The current consumption patterns pose no risk to consumers.
The issue was raised back in August by the ABC's Background Briefing program, where reporter Rachel Clayton first visited the laboratory of Dr. Kirsten Beckendorf from Southern Cross University. Here she is telling Gina McKeown about her investigation.
It starts in a university lab in the town of Coffs Harbour on the New South Wales North Coast.
So now we're going across into the chemical lab.
I'm being guided down a line of hallway through to a small, brightly lit room with two workstations.
We've got our blueberry samples here.
Dr. Kirsten Beckendorf is a marine scientist who's testing blueberries she bought from local supermarkets. Her results were pretty concerning. So she found that all of the blueberry samples had between 4 and 11 different types of pesticides in them. And among those pesticides was one that really got her attention, and it's called dimethylwhite. You might have heard of because it made headlines in recent years after the European Union banned it. But here in Australia, it's legal to use it. But for Kirsten,
the main concerning results about dimethylwhite were that three of those batches had concentrations of dimethylwhite that would exceed the acceptable daily intake for a 20-kilogram child with less than 20 grams.
Okay, I can feel a number of people would be freaking out right now. Parents who are thinking about their kids as well. So what does she mean by acceptable daily intake?
It's based on your weight. So it means, say there's an 80-kilo person and they ate over 80 grams of blueberries every day over the course of their life that contained this level of the pesticide dimethylwhite, they'd be consuming more than the federal regulator says you should be eating without risking your health. And if you're lighter, say you're 70 kilos, you'd hit that daily intake after 70 grams of these berries.
70 grams. That's not a lot. But is that legal? Are those levels legal?
Yeah, they are. So Kirsten's not saying the levels she found exceeded the legal limit. What she is saying is that the current legal limit, which is set with a safety buffer, is not adequate. So there are 8,000 different chemicals allowed to be used in Australia.
8,000 chemicals.
And Kirsten, that's our marine biologist, she says that that's actually why she believes her tests underestimate the amount of pesticide that was on her berry samples. Because when you test for this kind of thing, you can't test for 8,000 different chemicals. You have to pick the pesticides you want to search for. So a couple of weeks into this investigation, I went to the APVMA, that's the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicine Authority, and they're in charge of approving which chemicals are allowed into the country. And after I spoke to them, they quietly put something on their website saying that they're considering a ban of dimethylwhite on blueberries, raspberries and blackberries. And they said they're considering that because Australians are eating significantly more berries than they used to. And I pushed them on significantly and found out they mean our intake has gone up by up to 962% for some age groups.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's a really big jump because they haven't updated their data on how many berries we actually eat for 30 years.
30 years. Okay, so why does it matter that we're now eating so many more berries?
It matters because at the moment, and as I said before, it's perfectly legal for these farmers to use dimethoate at the levels detected by Kirsten. But the problem is that that's based on this assumption that we're eating way fewer berries than we do. So basically, we're eating more berries, so we're therefore eating more pesticide. So the limit for how much residue can be on each punnet needs to be lower.
Sounds like it should have been lowered a long time ago.
Yeah.
Rachel Clayton, who did the background briefing program on dimethoate. Well, Berries Australia chair Anthony Poynter says the industry accepts the regulator's decision, but argues the two-week withholding period is impractical and will drive up the cost of berries.
I accept it completely. They're custodians of keeping consumers safe, so I think that's great and they're doing their job.
And last time you spoke, you said that it would increase costs for growers and potentially for consumers.
Well, dimethoate is very effective against fruit fly. It's the most effective tool. But we do use integrated management to control fruit fly. So we will have one less tool in the armour in harvest season without dimethoate. We'll buckle down and use all of our brilliant agronomists to come up with what the best integrated strategies are going to be.
So integrated strategies means using everything in the toolbox to control the pest, fruit fly in this case. A New South Wales berry grower says new rules around the use of the chemical to control fruit fly will result in a big hit to yields. Emin Lell grows blueberries, raspberries and blackberries at Kirindi Beach. And he told Lauren Bohane there'll be challenges while growers adapt.
Fruit fly is quite a damaging sort of pest. It can explode in numbers very fast. And once you've seen it in your crop, it can sort of decimate your entire crop in days. So the challenge is that dimethoate was the only chemical that was known to actually kill the maggots that are inside the fruit and actually take them out and destroy their life cycle. So it completely eradicates their life cycle and you basically, one spray was enough to basically control them. Everything else can target different stages, like the adults that are flying around and that sort of thing, but nothing really targets that maggot that's already infested in the fruit.
What will this mean for berry growers? What's that going to mean for production?
There's going to be a big hit to yields, especially for growers who haven't already been trying the alternative methods, like the bait sprays and lure traps and that sort of thing. Traps that target the male, where there's a pheromone in a trap and it attracts them. They sit on it and it's laced with a little bit of chemical and basically kills the male. So it's not actually spraying anything on the fruit. It's just a little trap that you hang in the field every 20 or 30 metres down the rows. And then there is another one that targets the females, the mature females. And then there's a bait spray, which is basically for the immature females. When they first emerge, they actually want to feed on a bit of protein before they mature and are able to reproduce. It's like a protein that's laced with a little bit of chemical that you spray, on non-cropping areas where you haven't got, not directly on the fruit, and actually try and target that immature female before it actually develops and kill it that way.
Do you think that there'll be a drop in production while the industry adapts to these new control methods?
I think it's definitely possible, especially in high sort of pressure years. Like, fruit fly pressure varies from one season to the next. So in a season with high pressure, the alternative strategies aren't all that successful. In the long term, I think it could be a good thing. Growers learning how to do it. And if we can manage fruit fly with less chemical use, then at the end of the day, I see that as a win.
Kirindi Beach berry grower Emin Lell speaking to Lauren Bohane. So the key message is keep eating berries, they're full of goodness. But there's still a lot of chemicals being used on farms for good reasons, so it's a good idea to wash your fruit and veg anyway, especially when you're feeding them to small children.
David Claughton with that report, with additional reporting from Brandon Long and Rachel Clayton. 27-1, and Jonathan Beale with the headlines.
Thanks, Kate. A legal battle over the reported multi-million dollar estate of Virginia Giuffre has held its first hearing in the WA Supreme Court. Ms. Giuffre, who was allegedly trafficked for sex by billionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, died by suicide in April. The 41-year-old did not have a valid will and left multiple assets in WA. The state government says it's considering whether to change laws regarding alcohol delivery services, a rapid review by National Cabinet following a spike in domestic homicides last year, recommended limiting late-night alcohol deliveries. But one advocate involved in the review is calling on states to explain what they've done in the more than a year since the recommendation was made. WA's Racing and Gaming Minister Paul Papalia says alcohol delivery restrictions are being looked at. And the CEO of Lottery West, Colin Smith, says there's no excuse for illegal activity at its retail outlets. Several stores across Perth have been banned from selling lottery games after they were found to be selling undercover tobacco products. The stores were identified by a nationwide Australian Council of Smoking and Health audit, which found almost half of the more than 100 outlets investigated were selling illegal tobacco and vapes. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Jonathan.
You're listening to the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
25 away from 1 o'clock, and the news will be along at that time. Anyway, now it's time for the weather with Catherine Shelfout from the Bureau. Catherine, this Friday afternoon, what is happening across the Southwest Land Division and then into the weekend?
Good afternoon, Kate. Yes, quite cloudy along the south coast and around the southwest corner at the moment. Still quite cool as well, with temperatures still only around 19 degrees on the south coast in that southwesterly flow, but we will see conditions warming and drying over the next few days. So currently there's a ridge just sitting over the southwest corner, and from tomorrow, we'll see a large high-pressure system. It's not very strong, but it spreads over a long area, so it's sitting out over the Indian Ocean to the west of WA, but it will start to push that ridge right along the south coast tomorrow. So we'll see winds generally light south-southeasterly during Saturday and strengthening in the afternoon near the west coast and also along the south coast with the sea breeze, and that south coast sea breeze will push right up throughout southern districts during the afternoon and the evening. Not much weather going on, just a slight chance of a very light shower between Albany and Esperance tomorrow, but otherwise mostly sunny and dry. So temperatures tomorrow sitting from around 21 on the south coast up to 27 at Narrogin and 35 at Mullewa. On Sunday, that high starts to make its move south of the state, and we see a west coast trough forming. So winds will generally be east-southeasterly, stronger through northern and western parts of the Southwest Land Division, because we get a tight pressure gradient between the ridge south of the state and the west coast trough. So probably pretty windy morning around the Perth Hills and along the Darling Scarp there, sort of to the north and south a bit, through the central west as well, and we'll see temperatures warming up. So Eneabba up to 39 on Sunday, Meriden 33 and Katanning 30, and we will have a fire weather warning likely for the central west coast on Sunday. Monday, that high moves over the Eucla district and that west coast trough deepens even further and pushes right down to the southwest corner, and we get a low forming in the trough near the Gascoyne coast. So this will be the hottest day, Monday, near the west coast. We're going for 42 at Geraldton, 41 at Gingin, 36 at Harvey, but high 30s throughout the Wheatbelt and the Great Southern. And that's with northeasterly winds dragging that heat down to the southwest corner. They'll be fairly light in southern parts, but a bit fresh and gusty through northern parts of the Southwest Land Division. We do see that trough moving inland during the day, so winds will turn northwesterly near the trough and then southwesterly if you're near the west coast. We've got a chance of a thunderstorm north of about Durian Bay on Monday, and another fire weather warning likely again near the central west coast in those hot, windy conditions. And then finally for Tuesday, we get a new ridge moving in over the southwest corner, so that will push the trough inland, and we'll see a cool change near the west coast. So Geraldton dropping back from 42 down to 31 on Tuesday, but still remaining pretty hot inland in the high 30s and up to 41 at Morowa. So winds will be a bit variable on Tuesday with that trough moving through. It'll be easterly to start with, northeasterly through eastern parts, and then turning northwesterly in the late morning, and closer to the west and the south coast you'll get pretty fresh and gusty sea breezes from late morning. And the other thing with the trough on Tuesday is that it does bring the chance of a thunderstorm through inland parts of the central west and throughout the wheat belt as well.
What about if we move up now to the northern and eastern forecast districts, Catherine?
Yeah, so conditions easing through those parts as well. I know it's been really active earlier this week, and even yesterday and last night we had some severe storms through the interior. So those have all pushed off to the east at the moment. There is a chance that we'll still see some severe storms through eastern parts of the interior this afternoon, and just regular seasonal thunderstorms through the Kimberley and the Pilbara and northern Gascoyne today and tomorrow. But later in the week, they will start to push a bit further south, as I mentioned. Quite windy through central parts of WA tomorrow, so those east-southeasterly winds, but windier on Sunday and Monday. And by Monday, that sort of gusty southeasterlies will also have pushed right up to the southern Kimberley and the eastern Pilbara. And we will have a heatwave warning out for western parts of the Kimberley from tomorrow. We're seeing temperatures through places like Fitzroy Crossing and just west of there sitting around 43 degree maximums and minimums around 27, 28 degrees. So pretty hot up there at the moment.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you.
And now Richard Hudson is in the studio for the rainfall.
Yeah, not much to get through. In the Kimberley, Lansdowne recorded 7 and Wyndham 9. And then in the interior, Carnegie 11 and Warburton 7. And then in the southern coastal patch, Chain Beach topped it with 2. But that's about it. But I do have some breaking news today. It comes from the PGA, so the Pastoralists and Graziers Association. President Tony Seabrook has stepped down. So he's been in the role for 11 years and says it's time, but he's sort of warning us he's not actually going anywhere. I think he's going to be still on the board and still involved in the PGA, and to quote him, to defend our industry, he says. And this morning at the PGA AGM, it was announced long-standing Vice President Digby Stretch is going to be the new president. But on Monday's Country Hour, you will hear from Tony Seabrook himself, because I'm catching up with him this afternoon, and who knows, this evening we'll probably go doof-doofing.
Gosh, don't ever call it that again.
Hey, if you haven't seen it already, just check out the story on the ABC News page about what the caretakers at Berkeley River Lodge went through on Monday night when Tropical Cyclone Fina went over the top. The lodge is in the very far north of the state, so it's in a very remote part of the Kimberley. And you've actually seen it, haven't you, Kate?
Yeah, I have. I actually used to work on the boat, the Great Escape, which is a tourist boat up there, and it used to quite frequently pass the Berkeley River Lodge, and it is very exposed. Let's just say that.
Remote and exposed. Mm-hmm. Well, the caretakers, Laura Stokes and Adam Zerner, spent 16 hours in an underground sea container underneath the lodge area as that Cat 3 cyclone passed overhead. And when they emerged from the safe bunker, they described it as apocalyptic-like scenes of destruction. And when you see the photos, you'll see what they mean. So just search ABC News and Cyclone and you should find that story by Julia Bertolio. Tropical Cyclone Fina cracked the whip for those involved in the live exports of cattle as well at the Berrima Export Yards in Darwin. That's where Chris Giblett works, and he says they tried to rush thousands of head of cattle off the floodplains of the Top End before the cyclone came through, dumping lots and lots of rain.
We sort of loaded out a G-class vessel last Tuesday, started receiving Wednesday, as you all know, by Saturday evening we had a Cat 3 come past the yards, and then once it passed, obviously green light, keep going, fill it back up. The yards are now full when we're planning to load out over the weekend again. So yeah, it's been a pretty intense 7 to 9 days. Yeah,
what was it like on Saturday when the cyclone came through here at the yards?
Well, I wasn't here. I was only, you know, 5-10 minutes up the road at home. But we did a lot of prep and getting ready. Obviously, we knew for quite a few days beforehand. Got to make sure all cattle were in the sheds. We do have cyclone-rated sheds. We had good hay storage. We had other feed commodities. We had water backup planned in place. You know, we had everything put away. Just your general cyclone prep. And then, you know, it come through quite heavily. Berrima lost power early in the evening, and we got it back on I think Monday afternoon.
So what are you expecting between now and the end of 2025?
More cattle, more ships. 2 to 3 more. It's not going to be as intense as last year by the sounds of it. It's more so because of the way that the vessels are placed. They're sort of following each other, and it's very difficult. Obviously, we hold the equivalent of one G-class vessel, so we will just sort of do one and then we'll wait for the next one. But last year it sort of worked like clockwork, one in, one out, one in, one out, one in, one out. We were very tired and cranky by the end of it. This year might be a little bit more down to earth, but anything could change.
And I get that this is the story for all the export yards in the top end at the moment. They're full and they're busy.
Yeah, and we don't know when we're going to finish. People say the 16th, people say the 23rd, and people say the 28th. So we'll just keep going until they say stop, really.
Chris Giblett chatting to Matt Bran at the Berrimah Export Yards in Darwin.
And on the topic of live exports, as you know, Kate, earlier this week I was at the Live Exchange Conference that was on in Perth over a couple of days. So it's a national conference for those involved in live exports. And at the gala dinner, John Edwards was presented with the Ian McIver Lifetime Achievement Award and also inducted into the industry's Hall of Fame. So that was for recognition of a lifetime's worth of hard work and commitment to the whole live export industry. Live Corp Chairman Troy Setter, who we heard on the Country Hour earlier in the week, he presented the award and highlighted the tireless efforts of John Edwards over more than 40 years until his retirement earlier this year. Just getting back to the weather side of things, though, the southwest of WA wasn't affected by Cyclone Fina, but parts were certainly hit by some big storms that dumped hail and rain last weekend. Richard Delisale's family runs a small cherry orchard between Kirrup and Bailingup and says the rain couldn't have come at a worse time for them because it was shaping up as a really good season.
We sort of started picking last week. Everything was fine. Pick Friday, they were still good. Then we got 50 mil of rain Friday night, Saturday morning. Virtually the cherries all, by the time we got up in the morning, they were already starting to split and around the stems and down the sides. Looked like you'd walked around with a little machete and just tapped the skins of the cherries. That's what it looked like. Normally, if we leave them on the trees and you lose nearly all of them, so we had a brainwave this year. We'd try and pick them and dry them with fans and sort of try and salvage some. Well, we sort of put them, laid them all out, sort of went through them, picked all the stuff that had already cracked out, then put them in boxes in the cool room, got them out on the Sunday to try and pack some out of it, and I reckon another 30% had sort of either stems had let go or the skins had started weeping and cracking, so we chucked them out, sent the rest up to the metro market Sunday afternoon for Monday's market. For what we got, well, if I was paying wages, we would have wasted our time. Lucky it's a family affair, and virtually we got a third of what we got on the Friday market. But bucket for bucket, what we put in the cool room, I reckon it was close to 60% that we threw out.
You've spoken percentage-wise, but if we were talking about kilos, just to put
I 100 kilos, 125 kilos to the market, and I reckon I would have chucked 150 to 200 kilos out.
Yeah.
One variety, you know. I've never seen the trees have so much on. They were just a dark red to black colour, the whole tree. You could hardly see the leaves for, and I thought, geez, we're going to do all right out of these this year. Consequently, the rain coming, we didn't, but that's farming.
How is the rest of the season looking for you guys?
Season-wise, everything's got a good crop on the trees. Like I said, as long as we don't get hailstones, because I've been there and done that. I think it was Christmas Eve about 15 or so years ago, we got a hailstorm. Well, I picked most of it, got a lot of apples. I reckon 50% of the crop was hail marked. Luckily, there was a shortage that year and we still got reasonable money for seconds. But on a good heavy crop, all state-wise, well, they're virtually juice prices. But like I said, we're in that type of game. The insurance is out of the question. We could insure, but the premiums are that high. you'd have to sort of guarantee that you were going to get wiped out nearly every second year.
Richard Delisle speaking to Rachel Boothman.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
Every year's different.
The Country Hour.
It's about connecting with people.
Part of your community for 80 years.
Beautiful.
Weekdays at noon on ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
When I first joined in November of 1964, the first shots were being fired in the move to introduce the reserve price scheme in wool. You remember that, well, you mightn't, but people were sort of arguing across fence lines. Families were split by the decisions that people were making, and it was really a hard time for the wool grower. Well, I, as a young man, was a bit confused by this, but anyway, we went along with it. As you know, it lasted until about 1990 when we saw it fall over at Roma.
That's the late Colin Munro, former head of the ABC Rural Department, reflecting on the rise and fall of the wool floor price. Hello, I'm Annie Brown, and this year the Country Hour marks 80 years since it first went to air on ABC Radio on December 3rd, 1945. Let's head back to the 1970s. It was a turbulent time for Australian farmers, with many markets down. But for struggling wool growers, it was a time of change. In 1974, the much-debated wool floor price was introduced. The Australian Wool Reserve Price Scheme was set up to smooth out fluctuations in the market and give producers a minimum price for their wool. This is a report for the Country Hour by John Parker in 1974.
There's no doubt that most growers agree that there's a need for a floor price to be announced. The two organisations who claim to represent all of Australia's wool growers, the AWMPF and the AWGC, have both said they want an announced floor price and that it should be 300 cents a kilo for 21 micron wool. They won't accept anything less, and they think it should be announced before the new season. The feeling generally among wool growers could be summed up in this comment from New South Wales wool grower David Hodgkinson.
I think that the sooner they make it and end the uncertainty in the industry, the better, both from the overseas buyer's point of view and from ours.
What would happen, do you think, if they don't?
Well, I think that we'll see a repeat of the early 1970s, where you'll see sheep being sold off and the Australian wool clip going down again very rapidly.
Do you think growers generally would welcome some government announcement on a reserve price?
I'm sure that they would welcome it, and I'm sure that it would be good for Australia in the long run, because I'm quite sure that the government would make a profit on whatever the price they put in.
It seems that all agree then there should be announced floor price. The difficulty is, who should announce it, the government or the corporation? Whether a floor price is set or not depends on the government, but will it work? The chairman of Economic Wool Producers, Mr. Jim Maple Brown, told us that for a fixed floor price to operate, the government would need to hold 5 to 10 million bales of wool, and it would cost about $2,000 million to operate.
The government did come on board, and the scheme operated for 17 years. However, it was abandoned in 1991 despite protests from producers who wanted to keep it. In short, it led to a massive unsellable stockpile of wool, and the Australian Wool Corporation went broke trying to maintain the price. At the time, the AWC had 4.6 million bales of wool and a net debt of $2.4 billion. It was often referred to by the media as the Wool Mountain. This is then Minister for Primary Industries John Kerrin speaking to the ABC in 1991.
You said earlier today it was your most difficult decision ever. How difficult?
Oh, very. This is the Holy Grail. The reserve price scheme's been there 17 years. This came about as a result of a very bitter debate in the 1960s. This is a very tough decision.
And will this decision work this time, do you think?
Yes.
Over what period? 5 years?
Well, that's the idea.
And what will have happened to your average wool grower's income over that period of time?
They are not going to have very good incomes over this period. I believe they'll have better incomes than they would have if they tried to stay and continue to buy their own wool and try and set a price that the market had walked away from.
In the aftermath, many wool producers left the industry. And in 2025, it was predicted Australian wool production would fall to its lowest level in more than 100 years. Today, prices fluctuate based on market conditions, primarily driven by demand from China. China is the world's largest wool processing country, receiving about 85% of Australia's wool. Celebrating 80 years of rural stories on the Country Hour, I'm Annie Brown.
It's nice taking a trip down memory lane on a Friday afternoon. And I think it's a good point now to check in on this week's wool market with Justin Haydock, who I caught up with earlier this morning just for a bit of an update on this week's market, but also to get a bit more of an understanding on where global demand is at right now for our wool.
Not a bad market at all this week, Kate. So we've seen a big rise in the market last week, 80 to 100 cents over all micron groups. Skirtings were also up. This week, the market firmed up. It was down a little bit in the east, but we were relatively unchanged in the west. So the EMI closed at 1504 and was down 10 cents for the week, traded at 978 in US terms. The Australian dollar was relatively unchanged, was up 0.12 of a cent. 40,000 bales on offer for the week, so quite a large offering compared to what we have seen in the last month. Put a little bit of pressure on the market and a little bit of grower resistance with 9.6% passed in. But all in all, very good week for wool.
Okay, and what about next week? What's that going to look like?
So next week, we're looking at a total offering of 37,000 bales, so just down a touch on what we offered this week. Back to a one-day sale in Fremantle, and that'll be sold on Tuesday. We're offering 6,000. So I'll just quickly read through the market indicators as well. So 17 microns in the west closed at 20.48, and they were unchanged. 18 microns, 19.64, they were up 4 cents. 19 microns, 18.58, they were up 2. 20 microns, 18.02, they were up 4 cents for the week. 21 microns, 17.90, they were up 1 cent for the week.
As always, who was buying?
Major buyers for the week. You could probably have a guess.
I'm going to put my bets in, let's see, Techwell Trading.
Yeah, you're spot on, Techwell. And next?
PJ Morris.
But yep, you're correct. Look, honestly, it is the same buyers. It's probably four or five major buyers in the room that buy in, you know, week in, week out. At the end of the day, 85% of our wool does go into China. But I'd probably rather use this time to actually report on something else, maybe speak a little bit about supply or, you know, even global demand at the moment, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, because I understand that you were up in Perth speaking about this at a conference recently.
Yeah, so I was asked to speak at the AAAC, the Australian Agricultural Consultants Association. It made me sort of have a bit of a deep dive into what's happening. Obviously, the supply issue we're seeing at the moment speaks for itself, but what's happening more on a global demand basis. Through doing quite a bit of homework, I started to have a look at a few different charts. So one chart that's really good to look at is the Chinese PMI, so that's their Purchasing Manufacturing Index. So at the moment, that's trading relatively stable at an index of 51.6. So just to put things into perspective, post-COVID, when production really ramped up, that was trading around 57. Look, it's okay at the moment, but it's definitely been better. So Chinese demand is relatively stable, but we've seen a lot better in the past. European demand is quite weak. So if we look at the German manufacturing index, that is trading at 88 points at the moment. Just post-COVID, that was around 105 points. So that says to me that there's not a lot of production into Europe at the moment, and people aren't spending. The other thing you can look at as well is the Chinese apparel index. That's okay. It seems to have stabled. We had a massive spike post-COVID that has come right back since then. So China's okay. Europe is very weak.
What about the US?
So with the US, the tariffs have definitely had an impact. Since tariffs were introduced in 2018, Chinese have sourced other markets for their exports on wool. So a lot of it into Europe and a lot into other Asian countries like Japan. Last year, 2024, exports into the US started to increase at a lower production cost or unit cost. Exports into US have definitely increased, but what China have done is they've lowered their production costs, so there would definitely be a flow-on effect into our market from that. That includes cost of labour and the cost of, you know, the product they're actually buying as well. So exports have increased in the US, but at a lower cost.
What should growers be excited for coming into 2026?
Yeah, I think the market at the moment, Kate, It is promising. I think it's purely supply driven at the moment. AWTA have predicted that the market could be down another 20% this year as well. If demand stays the same, supply is down again, even if we get just a tiny little bit more of a demand, if Europe starts spending or if China and US come to more of an agreement on these tariffs, this will really help the market. But at the moment, up around $18 for a 21 micron, I think it's exceptional money. Hopefully we can see a little bit more of a lift on that. But at the moment, it's looking pretty stable.
Thanks for that, Justin. Anyway, I hope you have a great weekend, whatever it looks like. I will speak to you on the 1st of December. It's coming up to the news. It is 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.